to Books and Arts on RN this Saturday afternoon. I'm Sarah Kanoski.
Some men who've been so upset and thinking it's like I'm making it up or I'm being stupid. I'm like, have you seen any like graffiti of vaginas in your city? And I'm like, no. And I'm like, okay, but I'm not supposed to. I'm like, why are you not supposed to?
So Rita McFadden on what she says is missing, not just in our graffiti, but in our art museums. Also on the show, the most beautiful baritone in American music.
You look so peaceful, scare me. Don't die just yet, and leave me alone, alone, alone on this journey round the sun.
That's Bill Callahan, and he's coming to Australia soon. And our own Eddie Perfect on a surprising piece of musical theatre.
I think what appealed to me was it's about the relationship between parents and their kids, you know, that there's a letting go that has to happen at some point. You have to allow your children to leave and to live their own lives.
That's all ahead this afternoon on Books and Arts. I hope you can stay with me. Now, those of you listening with kids, be warned, this conversation may get explicit because we're talking about female genitals in art, or rather, the lack of female genitals. New York-based commentator Sarita McFadden got thinking about this after a stroll around the Metropolitan Museum one Wednesday afternoon, and she joins me now via Skype. Good afternoon, Sarita.
Good afternoon.
So, Sarita, you were in the Greek and Roman galleries of the Met, and what did you notice that Wednesday afternoon?
Well, as a regular visitor to the Met, and I know, like, and it's hilarious to me, I know the museum like the back of my hand. But after so many visits there, what I noticed is that when I was looking at the male statues, they were fully nude and very much rendered in detail, in a very particular kind of detail. It was an interesting juxtaposition of like, wait, all the women seem to possess a certain demure quality and a certain modesty, and the male statues seem to present a power stance, and that how the male form was represented seemed to be much more true to life.
So the male statues are anatomically correct, but what you're noticing on these really, you know, they're beautiful statues of women, amazing realistic detail all over the body, except where you would expect to see a vagina. What do you see instead?
You just see a smooth space. It's covered, or a smooth space to the extent that where the legs are closed or there is something draping over that does not suggest anything anatomically correct about the female form or the female body.
And it could be, I suppose, Sarita, that this is a sort of classical modesty.
I think it was, like, in many ways, I think it was a mark of modesty. But I think the question that piqued me was, why is that a mark of modesty? Why is the female form, why does the female body have to conform to that standard or that value? And the male bodies did not conform to that same standard or value. It seemed to imply something very unequal that I've taken for granted, just as a viewer and an appreciator of the art form.
So, Sarita, as you're walking around the Met and noticing, in a way, for the first time, the fact that, as you put it, all these hoo-has are smooth, what is it, which is a great term. I actually think we should use hoo-ha. I like hoo-ha.
The hoo-ha. Oh, indeed.
What did it get you thinking about when you started reflecting on that contrast?
One of the things that struck me, in a sense that because the vulva was absent, it made me wonder also in terms of how we educate ourselves about, like, about sexuality, about female sexuality, to the extent, like, going back to, like, elementary school where where boys ask really ridiculous questions or, like, to the extent that they're like, or when we do sex ed, particularly when we're trying to educate, you know, young people in terms of being sexually responsible adults and teaching them consent and teaching them what, you know, in a very heteronormative sense, what sexuality is and what sex is, and their astonishment of not necessarily having any familiarity with the female body, but they're so familiar with seeing their own image everywhere.
And that real contrast, as you say, that's sort of, you know, made literal in those statues where the male body is not something to be ashamed of, it's something to be heroically celebrated, while the female body, the female sexual body is erased in art.
Yes. Erased in art and erased in culture. So in a way, if it's not visually represented, then it's perpetuating a certain kind of narrative about what our bodies should mean in public space.
And how has that continued up to now, Sarita? Because, of course, we are thousands of years on from those statues of classical antiquity.
Well, culturally, we're still scandalized by the female body. When we think about how still, even in like in a realm of like the 21st century, and we have the most amazing technology available to us, Facebook still censors and deletes Courbet's painting, The Origin of the World. It's still erased. It's still deleted. It's still marked as pornography. The concept that the female body, particularly like the vagina and the vulva, is still classified as pornography. You can't post a nude body on Instagram or Facebook. It's immediately deleted. It's these small little things that kind of still, we still question that. We're still flummoxed by seeing a naked female presence.
It's complicated though, isn't it, Sarita? Because obviously the web is such a site of pornography, of sort of exploitation of female bodies, of really graphic violence against female bodies. So there's this weird, on one hand, this sort of frenzy of pornography, and then still a real anxiety and sort of horror at just the biological reality of female bodies. I mean, it seems to go both ways in a very strange way in our culture at the moment.
I would certainly agree, and I really love that you put that in a way that you did, the biological reality of female bodies. What's fascinating is I wonder if we had not been taught to believe that all the feminine body needs to be covered, or to normalize it, to accept that like it's normal to see a woman's body and not immediately assign some sort of sexual identity or performance to it, or assign some pornographic violence to it.
It's curious, there have been a few works recently by contemporary artists who kind of really aim to address exactly the hiddenness of the female hoo-ha. There's a work by an American artist, Jamie McCartney, called The Great Wall of Vagina, which is plaster casts of 100 or so vulvas. And there's a similar work by an Australian artist, actually, Greg Taylor, that's at the Museum of Old and New Art in Hobart, which I think it's porcelain casts of vulvas. And it's got a title that's too rude to say on radio. We'll just say it's something along the line of hoo-ha's a conversation. You know, so these are works that are aiming to really forefront, look, this is the reality that art has shied away from or been too terrified of, which on one hand is a great thing, a powerful thing. It's interesting, though, both those artists are men. I wonder if that signifies anything.
I mean, it does signifies something interesting, but there are certainly female artists that have tried to challenge our perception and understanding, our continual cultural narrative that a naked female body is something to feel shameful of. So I'd point to Micheline Thomas, who basically did a lovely cover, an update, if you will, or homage to Courbet's painting called The Origin of the Universe. But in this case, it's subversive in the sense that it's this modern retake makes it a black female body, of which, you know, we see the fully correct female, anatomically correct vagina shown. I think Hannah Wilkie is the other artist. Her piece needed to eraser, where she needed erasers into vaginal shapes, because again, this is in her work, I want to say it's at least 25, 30 years old, but it was again, a woman witnessing, visiting art galleries and museums and noticing that there's an absence, and noticing, as I did, that male bodies were in fact presented everywhere. And there's, and the thing that, like, part of the reason why it so struck a chord with me and made me, like, kind of astonished at myself and kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek kind of giggle about it is, like, that was normalized to me. I didn't question it before. I've gone to the museum so many times, and I never questioned it. Of course, I fully expected to see the male form anatomically correct and represented, and I'm not scandalized by it. But the flip, I'm not conditioned to even accepting the female represented in the same way.
The female form is shocking, and the male form we accept and don't take as signifying as some radical gesture. But with a female body, it is still seen that way, as you say, even though there is now a 25, 30-year tradition in contemporary art of trying to show that differently.
Right.
And
right.
It's interesting, Sarita, we're talking, you know, high art examples, but you also make the point about graffiti, that how often do we see male genitalia drawn on toilet doors, on subways, on, you know, footpaths, but not the female body?
No, you don't. It's rare. I think I've seen it maybe once on a subway wall in New York City in Bleecker. I think someone got fed up with seeing dick pics everywhere, that they vandalized the tile of the Bleecker Street Station on the 6th. And I was like, huh. I'm like, I guess you're right. I never see this. I'm like, not that I'm really advocating for property damage, but, you know, maybe, you know, little subversion.
Well, Sarita McFadden, it has been a pleasure speaking to you on Books and Arts today. Thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you so much.
Sarita McFadden is a Guardian US opinion writer, and we've put a link to her piece on Art's Missing Hoo-Has on the Books and Arts page. I'm Sarah Kanoski. American singer Bill Callahan is up next on Books and Arts.
Is your family normal?
Everybody just pretend to be normal, okay? Like everything's normal here.
Frankly, in this day and age, that'd be a little weird. On RN Showcase, Radio Housewives, a new series that looks at the way families really live today.
Call this a happy family. Why do we have to have all these kids?
Surprising choices and surprisingly inspiring families. Join me, Susan Mousehart, for Radio Housewives on RN Showcase, Sunday at 3:30.
Bill Callahan has been making influential music for the last 25 years or so. His latest album is the critically acclaimed Dream River. Bill's coming to Australia later this month for a show in Melbourne, and he's then appearing at the Opera House as part of Vivid Live. I spoke to Bill Callahan from his rehearsal shed in Austin, Texas. Let's hear a little from America First. It comes from his 2011 album, Apocalypse.
America, 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 you are so grand and golden. Oh, I wish I was deep in America tonight. America, America, I watched David Letterman in Australia. Oh, America, you are so grand and golden. I wish I was on the next flight to America.
So, Bill Callahan, at the end of this month, you're playing two shows in Sydney and then one in Melbourne. You wrote a really great song about an earlier trip to Australia, but one that's maybe surprisingly called America.
Yeah, I mean, it's Australia played a small part in it.
We take whatever cameo appearance we can get in a Bill Callahan song.
Yeah, well, so you should.
So that's a song about being lonely in a hotel room and thinking about your home country.
Yeah, that part of it is definitely. I was just kind of feeling, I was feeling homesick, and David Letterman came on at, I don't remember, it was like 10 o'clock every night or something. That was kind of my lifeline back to the States. And even though I was in really beautiful surroundings by the beach, but even all that couldn't like outshine the like a TV show from America at this, at that moment, you know.
There's a really great part of that song where you name-check country stars and give their military rank, like Captain Christofferson and Sergeant Cash. Is that the army you think of yourself as belonging to?
Oh, I think I'm probably too puny and pigeon-toed to get in that army.
It's a really beautiful video too, Bill, and you've made some amazing videos. I just looked this morning at Javelin Unlanding, where you're painted as a moon, and then Small Plane, where it's a silent movie of a woman in love with a man who appears on soup cans. Are you involved in the creation of those music videos for your songs?
Yeah. With America video, someone else was producing it, but we talked a lot about things as they were developing, and that one was interesting to me because the people that were animating it, they took the song to be a really negative song, which it's not supposed to be. So there's a lot of like ugly American images that I had them cut out of there because it like wasn't like the entirety of the song, you know.
That's interesting. I mean, does that happen a bit with your music? Are you surprised at the meaning people take out of them? I mean, I know you're often described as kind of melancholy, but your songs, particularly on your most recent album, Dream River, are such hopeful songs, really, in a way. They're really attuned to the possibilities of human connection, and they're not melancholy to me as a listener anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I noticed that particularly with the first song off my last record. It's called The Sing, and it's about a guy sitting in a bar and just by himself and thinking, and at the end he has a sort of a revelation, and to me it's like it's an uplifting song. I mean, it's uplifting because, you know, when you realize anything in your life or about yourself, it's a positive thing, because that's kind of what we're doing on Earth, is just trying to figure out who we are and what it means to be a human being and who other people are. And so in the song, you know, this guy has a revelation, but I think a lot of people they see the guy sitting in the bar alone, and that's like, that's as far as they can go with it or something.
Well, the only words I've said today are beer and thank you. Quiet way, like a church, like a church, like a church that's far away. Na 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 na.
You some flute a lot, Bill, in this album and the ones before. You know, I always feel it's a bit of a dangerous instrument. It sort of is got that prog rock association.
Well, I think there should always be someone wearing Birkenstocks in the studio when I'm recording. It's like, I think it's an overly maligned instrument, and I've noticed that people only hear it when it's bad, and when it's in a lot of songs, but you hear it kind of unconsciously, and I think people probably don't even realize how much flute they've enjoyed in their lives. So I think it's a really unconscious instrument.
Sometimes it's hard to know when to call it an evening. See, as much as we can stand till we're staggered, laying all twisted together and exposed, like roots on a riverbank. Bam, bam, the earth off its axis.
This is Books and Arts on ABCRN. I'm Sarah Kanoski, and I'm speaking with musician Bill Callahan, who's coming to Sydney and Melbourne later in May. Bill, your baritone is such a beautiful, beautiful voice. It's so distinctive. And you use really interesting, unexpected phrasing a lot of the time. In the song Winter Road from your latest album, Dream River, it's got this line, I don't have a distinctive, beautiful baritone, so I won't attempt to sing it, but it says, I've learned when things are beautiful, just keep on. And the words that you choose to sort of accentuate in that are the words that seem, you know, they're not the nouns, they're the ones that you think are least important, that's are and just. Is the phrasing of a song something you're working with consciously when you're writing the lyrics, or does that happen in performance?
I don't know how that particular thing happened, really. I usually just keep singing something until it sounds right to me. You know, I think there's a magic, because, I mean, singing is already an abstract thing. Like, we don't really know why we like to listen to people sing, but I just try different things until I feel like a listener that is not offended.
That's all you're aiming for. That's a bit of a low bar. I don't know about that, but you it goes for the structure of your songs as well. I mean, rather than this traditional verse, chorus, verse, that up and down, you have often a much dreamier, kind of floatier, associative thing happening in the structure of your songs.
Really, a structured song to me feels a little bit like a prison or just a big wooden box that gets dropped over my head or the listener's head. And especially when I'm making a record, I know that this is the reality that I'm going to be living for a couple of years as I tour for the record. So the songs need to be a comfortable place where I can stretch out and where I can not feel confined, you know.
I know that lots of people now listen to music kind of on shuffle, you know, on a bit of a random order. But your albums, you know, tend to have a really strong arc in terms of the way the songs relate or kind of build from one another. Is that something that you keep in mind when you're doing a set list too for a tour? I mean, how the songs are going to relate narratively to one another or melodically?
Totally. It's something I think about it every day on tour and if it can make it better and all that. But I also start sequencing my albums before the songs are even finished, and sometimes it's just a title. I might have nothing, no music or lyrics, but I know sort of the feel. And I always start sequencing. I'm constantly like shuffling the sequence of that as I'm working on the songs, so I'm shuffling the sequence of something that doesn't even exist, but I kind of write from the outside in. You know, I'm always thinking about that. I don't know if anyone else even hears it, but it gets me to finish the songs when I think like that. So
that that's an important thing for any songwriter. Bill Callahan, thanks so much for joining me on Books and Arts. It's a real pleasure to speak with you.
Thanks, you too.
Oh, I have learned when things are beautiful to just keep on, just keep on. Oh, when things are beautiful, just lights. Oh, the kingdom can make you weep. Oh, I have learned when things are beautiful to judge. Keep on, just keep on. Oh, when things are beautiful, just keep on.
Bill Callahan is playing a show in Melbourne later this month and then at the Opera House as part of Vivid Live. If you're lucky enough to get to either of those, please let me know if he's as good in concert as I suspect he will be. You can do that at the Books and Arts Facebook page or Twitter. I'm at Sarah Kanoski. And I actually spoke to one of our own great songwriters, Robert Forster, about Bill Callahan's music a little while back, and we've put a link to that at the Books and Arts page too. Now, do you have a creative idea that could change the way we experience art and culture? Do you want to win a prize to share it with creative and business leaders from all over the world? You do? Well, keep listening. A lot about how culture could, in fact, should be energized by bringing business and technology. Peter Tullen is at the vanguard of bringing these worlds together. He's the co-founder of Remix Summits. That's an international gathering that's happening next month in Sydney. Peter Tullen, welcome to Books and Arts. So, who comes to a Remix Summit?
The really sort of interesting and fun thing about Remix is about this juxtaposition of creative leaders from different worlds. So, for example, our most recent event in New York, we had fantastic sort of minds from places like NASA or the creative director of Cirque du Soleil, alongside people like the director of the MoMA Gallery in New York, media organisations like Mashable, you know, or Cool Hunting or The Guardian, people from the Smithsonian and the Met Museum. So this really kind of interesting mix of entrepreneurs, you know, scientists, artists, you know, people from business, and really to approach these kind of subjects and topics such as, you know, what is the future of arts and culture, or, you know, where is marketing going? How do we think about new ways to create and distribute content, to really sort of approach that from a very kind of cross-disciplinary point of view. And the theory behind it all being that if you put, you know, amazing sort of bright people from different worlds together, then sort of new types of ideas and innovations will emerge. And of course, those conversations we hope will lead into collaborations, which has been one of the sort of the big outputs of Remix.
There's such different worlds, you know, the example of someone from NASA and someone from Cirque du Soleil. What kind of real meaningful conversations can be had there? I mean, is it always kept at a kind of superficial level, just given how different the sort of worlds that a scientist and an artist, say, are coming from?
Well, I think sort of ultimately we're all, I mean, this word disruption is used a lot. You know, we talk about the way the music industry or film or TV with things like Netflix is being disrupted. And I think sort of arts and culture is no different. And if you're talking about, you know, the future of mobile and the way the physical and the digital world are starting to blur, then, you know, it makes sense to have a conversation which absolutely involves pioneers within the cultural field, you know, somebody from, you know, the Sydney Opera House who may be doing something, you know, fantastically innovative in that space. But you also want a wider conversation with people who are obviously within that sort of mobile world. So you can make that leap sort of 5-10 years ahead about, you know, sort of what's next. And to give you an example, I was fortunate enough to get a tour around the Met Museum the other day by their sort of first ever chief digital officer, and he took me into a part of the gallery where I had this fantastic sort of Van Gogh painting known as sort of First Steps, which is, if you know the painting, it's where a sort of father is working in the field and his wife is bringing the sort of child to the father, and basically earlier that day the theory is that the child had sort of taken its first steps and the mother is about to release the child so it can walk to its father for the first time. And I was talking to Sri, who was the chief digital officer, and he suddenly got out his mobile phone, and he had an app on there called Blipper, which is a really clever app, which is about sort of augmented reality. And he took a tiny little sort of snapshot of just one piece of the painting, and immediately the app recognised, you know, what the painting was and the artist and the context, and it created incredibly detailed animation. And suddenly the child, you know, walked from the mother's arms across to the father. So you know, for some people, bringing alive that story in a way that sort of still physical image can't ever hope to achieve, obviously beyond your own imagination, you know, is a really interesting additional way of experiencing that artwork beyond obviously the work itself and perhaps that sort of classic sort of arts label that, you know, sits to one side, which can only give you a certain amount of information.
It's interesting, Peter, because, I mean, that obviously that kind of digital experience of a painting is not at all what the painting itself is about. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people have enjoyed that painting and had a meaningful relationship with it as, you know, I guess a static object. Do we really get more out of a painting through having that sort of digital experience with it? I mean, I guess this is one example, but I guess that criticism can be made about some of this digital interaction with artworks, that it's kind of gimmicky. It doesn't actually really deepen our relationship with a work necessarily.
I think that's a very interesting point as well. And I think, look, we would all say within our everyday lives, we know we're very much aware that the world is going digital. And for every trend, actually, there is a counter trend. So, of course, some people will go into that gallery looking to escape the mobile phone, you know, looking for that analog experience. And of course, as you say, for hundreds of years, these things have been enjoyed as objects. And, you know, I'm 110% behind that sort of theory as well. And I think, you know, that's another great reason why sort of museums, galleries, cultural institutions are so popular, because they're offering that sort of real, that sort of physical experience. But I think, you know, in the world that we have today, also when we think about the different types of audiences, you know, sort of, you know, young people, for example, you're thinking actually, the way I would look at it is almost you're looking at different types of journeys into that artwork. And I think for some people that will add something to the experience. But also there are limitations to obviously what you can do with a physical object in terms of other places you might want to take people.
Obviously, a really important thread in all of this, as well as the technology and the art and culture, is business, is entrepreneurship, which is still sometimes sits a bit awkwardly against art and culture. But the way you talk about it is that the sort of cultural entrepreneurship is something really exciting. It's not just about generating money. It's a way about thinking differently about ideas.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I think, you know, entrepreneurship is an incredibly sort of positive thing, and it can be applied clearly to a number of different contexts. And, you know, if you think about sort of culture and commerce, and absolutely people have had those debates about how far do you go, you know, is this necessarily a kind of good thing? Should it remain sort of pure? But I think there's a number of realities where now, you know, clearly, as we've seen in many parts of the world, you know, public funding has been withdrawn. You know, it's a sort of separate debate, or has certainly been sort of reduced. So organisations are having to diversify their sort of funding mix like lots of other parts of society. But the way I look at it is actually a lot of this is about how you sort of build audiences. Because if you look at a lot of the great entrepreneurs in, say, the technology space, you know, where they've found hundreds of thousands or millions of followers or fans or visits to websites, in effect, they've created something which people really, really want to engage with. And then on the back of that, they've found a clever way to monetize that relationship. And I tend to look at sort of entrepreneurship in the cultural sector as a similar way. It's not you know, overtly sort of commercial or kind of money for money's sake. It's actually about delivering a wider range of kind of interesting experiences for people that you can generate income from also. So to give you an idea, there was a very sort of clever entrepreneur in the UK, a guy called Richard Reed, who is behind a company called Innocent Smoothies. And he, you know, was very fortunate, sort of a couple of years ago, managed to sell that business for a lot of money to Coca-Cola. And rather than sort of becoming a classic philanthropist, he sort of took the sort of view that he wanted to act as an entrepreneur in the projects that he worked on within the arts world. So he was wandering down a road one day and sort of spotted a billboard and just had this very sort of simple idea, actually, that why couldn't we put art on billboards across the UK and create the UK's biggest ever art show, you know, really get that sort of art outside of the walls of galleries. And then what he was able to do was to go and talk to a number of the sort of the major advertising companies as an entrepreneur, and managed to secure around 30,000 billboards. So over a period of around about a week, he reached about 80% of the UK population and pulled on board like a number of the really big galleries like the Tate. But what was very clever, of course, is you could go around and, you know, you may be on the tube or the underground in London, and one of those digital billboards, you saw, you know, an artwork, and, you know, you just came across it in your everyday life. Again, you could use your phone to purchase a sort of copy of that artwork, you know, as a kind of poster. And I think that was great because it was obviously generating an income which also could go back to the art galleries. And it was just a very different way of experience art. And it was so successful in terms of the buzz that it created about taking art onto the streets. A year later, they repeated the project in America and got somewhere near a sort of 60,000 billboards, and, you know, worked with organisations like the Whitney over there.
It strikes me there's a real attitude difference here too, Peter, because knowing, say, at least the case in Australia, lots of arts organisations are still heavily dependent on government funding. And as, you know, as has been the case in the UK, that funding gets reduced often. Sometimes it can get reduced dramatically. And there's a sort of almost defeatist attitude that can really come aboard arts organisations, particularly smaller ones. You know, people are drawn to work in them because they've got a passion for whether it's theatre or dance or visual art, and then, you know, can get incredibly, I think, depressed, overwhelmed by the sense that, well, there's just never enough money.
Well, look, I think, you know, clearly there's going to be sort of challenges in that respect, and you know, I firmly believe it's about a diversity of funding, and, you know, and public funding plays its role within that. On the kind of flip side, I you know, agree, it's easy to get sort of negative about these things, but, you know, I very much see this as a golden age for arts and culture, certainly in terms of, you know, the appeal to sort of a very, very wide range of audiences. So, you know, if you look at places like Australia, you know, there are lots of figures coming out around sort of record attendances. You know, again, if I look at experiences like New York and London, you know, and in the UK, more people are going to cultural venues than are going to live sports sporting events. So have you looked at it from an opportunity in terms of the size of the market? You know, again, perhaps sort of relate it to a business term. You know, while something like culture perhaps doesn't have the television deals or something like, you know, Premier League football would have in the UK, in terms of actual participation, it's a bigger sector. So I think then the opportunities to be sort of entrepreneurial are actually, I would say, are very positive, because you're in a kind of growth market, if you want to call it that. And I think, especially as, you know, cities are growing, and obviously in Australia, you look at some of the stats around places like Sydney and Melbourne and the population projections, it becomes really, really exciting as a sort of new market.
Peter Tullen, he's a founder of Remix Summits, which aims to identify the ideas shaping the future of culture and the creative industries. And if this has got you excited, then why not pitch an idea to Remix 2015? RN has joined with Remix to offer tickets to the summit and also flights to Sydney for someone who's got a clever, creative idea that will change the way we experience arts and culture. And like the examples that Peter Tullen gave, yours could be big or small, could apply to a country town, a city, or even the whole country. And all the details for that are at the RN homepage, so get pitching. On Saturday afternoon, I'm Sarah Kanoski, and you're with Books and Arts on RN.
When I was young, my sister worked at Bunnings. Saturday morning, she put on her uniform. She worked the barbecue, made sausages in bread for men as they shopped for their hardware needs and such.
The voice and sharp satiric eye of Eddie Perfect. A song about Bunnings might be, well, perhaps painfully relevant to you this Saturday afternoon. Eddie Perfect is a comedian, composer and actor. He's the creator of Shane Warne the musical and of the cabaret show Songs from the Middle, which he made with the renowned Brodsky Quartet. And My Sister Works at Bunnings comes from that collaboration. And Eddie Perfect is in our masterpiece chair this Saturday.
I've chosen a musical by one of my favourite composer-lyricists, a guy by the name of Adam Gettle, who is the grandson, great-grandson of Richard Rodgers.
Grandson. Two generations,
yeah.
Yes.
That's right, yes, because his mother is Mary Rodgers, who's also a composer-lyricist who passed away recently, and she is the daughter of Richard Rodgers, Rodgers and Hammerstein. And Adam Gettle is an incredible composer, kind of almost, I don't know if you want to whack a label of a style on it, sort of neoclassical. He writes with intensely interesting, varied, surprising harmony, but he has such a strong affection at the same time for melody and for character in the theatrical form. And I've been a fan of his ever since I first heard one of his first recordings, which was a sort of a song cycle called Myths and Hymns. And the piece that I brought in today is a musical called The Light in the Piazza, which took quite a long while for me to really get into because it is, for want of a better word, romantic.
Can you summarise the plot for us?
Sure. So we're in 1950s and a mother and her daughter, her young daughter, well, she's 26 years old, they're on a holiday, a cultural kind of holiday, the mother and daughter in Italy, and by chance the daughter, Clara, her hat flies away and it's caught by this young Italian man, and they have this instant connection. As fate would have it, and the persistence of the young boy Fabrizio, they keep running into each other and they have such a strong connection. And the mother desperately tries to keep them apart for the reasons that are quite personal. And as it transpires, she doesn't succeed. And the story is really about the mother's journey from sort of fierce protectiveness to realizing through the love affair that's blossoming with her daughter and this Italian boy Fabrizio that in her own life she has no love. The love has gone out of her marriage. That she feels a lot of guilt towards her daughter for the situation she finds herself in mentally and physically. And there's a sort of a change that occurs. We eventually realize that the young girl at the age of 12 had a birthday party where they rented a Shetland pony, and the pony had kicked her in the head while the mother was distracted, and she sort of blamed herself for the fact that her daughter developed abnormally emotionally. You know, she can't handle intense situations. She's quite childlike. But none of those problems seem to matter to the Italian boy and to his family. There's a kind of a such cultural differences that her panic and anger and these massive emotional outbursts sort of fit
They're
with
normal.
The Italian paradigm of expressiveness. It's really interesting. And, of course, the husband at home refuses to allow his daughter to get married, but the mother is eventually convinced by Clara. She sings this amazing song called The Light in the Piazza, where they're going from, you know, monument to monument, statue to, you know, to fountain. And what the daughter is interested in is the spaces in between, the way the light illuminates those places, that intangible, unknowable thing, that thing that is what you could just romantically classify as love. And the mother eventually decides to give her blessing to her daughter and allow her to marry Fabrizio and to walk away from both her custodial, you know, relationship with her daughter and then also from her own loveless marriage. It's very moving, very complex. I think what appealed to me was it's about the relationship between parents and their kids, you know, that there's a letting go that has to happen at some point. You have to allow your children to leave and to live their own lives. And it just happens that the deck is stacked in The Light in the Piazza because there is the added stress of the guilt of this accident, uh-huh. of the fragility of her daughter, and also of the fact that she has been hiding the fact that she and her husband are not in love. That's incredible.
Oh, and so did you see it, or have you seen it on stage, Eddie?
Look, I came to it via the cast recording, as I sort of came by most of Adam's work, but I discovered that PBS filmed the Lincoln Center Broadway production, which was directed by Bart Scher, who I had the intense privilege of working with on South Pacific, a really clever, clever director. And so I watched it on YouTube, of all places. Anyone can watch it on YouTube if they search The Light in the Piazza. And it's not the best place to watch a musical on YouTube, but I've discovered that if something's gripping and fantastic, it holds you. And,
and you say it didn't grip you straight away, though. I mean, because as you describe it, it's a romantic. I mean, you know, in the wrong hands, it would be a sentimental story. You know, how did it? What was it about it that got you?
Yeah. It's the relationship between the score, the music and lyrics, and the book. The book's written by Craig Lucas. The music is intensely romantic, quite operatic in places, quite fragmented and strange harmonically, and quite dissonant in places, but very melodic and quite lushly orchestrated in a way that was a little bit off-putting to me when I heard just the music. But what the book does is the book almost understands where we're at with the material, and the dialogue is really it's really direct and kind of emotionally potent without being inflated. It's quite pragmatic, the book. You also have this incredible device where the mother just stops at a point kind of quite, you know, late into the piece and talks directly to the audience. She breaks out into these kind of these monologues with the audience, and she kind of harnesses the piece really in this sort of real reality between, you know, these epic soaring romanticism of this music and of love in general, and the pragmatic thing of you can't just let your daughter, who has an emotional intellectual disability brought on by a traumatic accident, just wander into the arms of some Italian guy she's met for 5 minutes. So it guides you through in a very clever way, and I think that's what, apart from the mother-daughter dynamic, that was what really struck me.
On Books and Arts, you're hearing from Eddie Perfect, and he's describing his masterpiece this week, which is an American musical called The Light in the Piazza. So, Eddie, has it influenced your own writing, do you think, your own lyrics or your own music writing, this work?
Yeah, it has. I'm sitting right now thinking about what I'm going to write as a next musical. I've got, you know, a TV show in development. I've got a play in development. But I really, you know, music theatre is a form that I really love. I feel like, you know, it has a wider palette of things you can, of colors you can draw on to tell stories, and you can really dig into emotion. You can also open characters up in a way that you can't.
Because of the song, because this is the musical theater genre is a little bit closed to me, I have to confess.
It is song. It is song in a way that, you can create soliloquies that don't really have a place on the straight dramatic stage and haven't since, I would possibly argue, Shakespeare. So you get to kind of stop a moment and go inside a character in a way that you kind of can't necessarily with a theatrical piece. But it's also just sonically. Music, everyone has, you know, like a pre-wired response to sound, to music, whether it's particular genres of music, whether you're using jazz or world music or folk or, you know, Afrobeat or hip-hop, no matter what that is, you've got this ready-made emotional landscape that you can either use the lyrics to go with or you can use the lyrics to fight against in a way that's also very interesting. And I like it because for what I do, I'm kind of interested in, in a crass sort of way, investigating, you know, middle class, really. That's been a lot of what my work has been about, and generally making middle class people sort of feel bad about themselves, but entertained enough so that they, you know, they're happy to pay their money and sit down and listen to it. You know, it's quite investigative, and I use comedy to do that, and I also think music does that really well. It's a poetry you get to unveil in front of people, and people will kind of suspend, if you do it well, they'll suspend their disbelief that they're hearing quite a poetic idea. And a song is such a wonderful form because, you know, you take a lyrical idea, something kind of almost intangible. So like this, for example, the light in the piazza. What is the light in the piazza? And when Clara is explaining to her mother what it is about love and what she's searching for, she talks about this light, and it's not the things, it's not the statues, it's not the stone, it's not the buildings, it's the way the light reacts to those things, that intangible thing that you can't quite describe, but it's inside and it's kind of tearing you apart. And a song gets to explore that very poetic thing in a way that a monologue would just make everyone run for the aisles.
That actually puts it well for me. You may have opened up my ears to musicals in a new way, Eddie Perfect. Thank you.
Look, I understand there's a barrier for a lot of people because, you know, they're like, okay, everyone's breaking into song. Look, there are two, without trying to just kind of generalize, there are two kinds of music theatre forms going on at the moment on Broadway, and the most popular one by far is this kind of amusement park for adults, which is not to say that it's not enjoyable, but, you know, songs are intensely witty or funny or surreal, and it's an enjoyable kind of musical theatrical roller coaster ride. But there, something like The Light in the Piazza, I think, sits very comfortably alongside some of the best non-musical dramatic works in that it really does seriously, through music, try to elicit a kind of an emotional response that is complicated and challenging and kind of ephemeral, I think.
Because you are a musical performer, you could be in a version of your masterpiece. I mean, what about being part of some Australian tour of The Light in the Piazza?
Yeah, I less and less kind of covet that sort of reality anymore because, you know, there's a weird thing when you write a piece. I generally try to not imagine myself in it anymore because they're two very different realities. There's the reality of creating something, you know, a world, and then finding the right cast to perform that and for them to have the right discipline. And I seem to be, you know, less and less interested in locking myself away performing a piece and much more interested in creating them.
Well, Eddie Perfect, we look forward to talking to you on Books and Arts in the future about things you've created as well as things you admire. Thanks a lot for sharing your masterpiece.
Thanks for letting me rave on.
And that's Books and Arts for this Saturday on ABC RN. I'm Sarah Kanoski. I'll catch you next Saturday at 2. Enjoy the rest of your afternoon.
Xi Jinping is China's paramount leader, which means he's in charge of the world's largest economy, prompting this comparison from Francis Fukuyama.
He may actually end up being the most powerful Chinese leader, not even since Deng Xiaoping, but since Mao Zedong.
But what will he do with this unprecedented personal power? Join us for that and a look at the crisis unfolding in Yemen. That's Between the Lines with me, Tom Switzer, Sunday morning at 10, here on RN.